Good afternoon, everybody. I guess I'd like to ask the children, are any of the children here today familiar with the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Has anybody? I know you are. Would anyone like to come up and tell the congregation about Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Do I have a volunteer? Because I'll have to do it myself if you won't. All right. Goldilocks, a little girl, breaks into the bear's house and she finds a chair and a bowl of porridge and a bed that are just right. And there were two of them. One bowl of porridge was too hot and one chair was too hard and so on and so forth. We know that whole story. But she found one set of accommodations for herself that were just right. And I titled this sermon, The Goldilocks Universe. And I thought I had come up with that idea, and then I found out that recently a gentleman, a physicist named Paul Davies, had published a book called The Goldilocks Universe. Because scientists have come to understand that our universe, miraculously, has been fine-tuned to be just right for life. We live in a Goldilocks universe. So in his book, Paul Davies describes how our universe has been constructed in just the correct way to support living creatures. So we find ourselves inhabiting a universe and a planet in a solar system and a galaxy that are just right. God has apparently tinkered with the structure of space and time and matter in order to give man and all the other creatures that he's put on planet Earth a fitting place to live. He has constructed the universe with exceedingly great care and prudence. But many scientists find that the idea of a creator and a designer is unattractive. They deny the existence of a creator because of the implied requirement of obedience to such a creator. Because they are respected by virtue of their education, their lofty credentials, their intelligence, we might wonder if they are right and we're wrong. Is life, is the universe just a lucky accident? We need today to explore the wonders of creation to solidify our faith in the facts of the Creator's work. The truth that God created and crafted and fine-tuned the universe cannot be dismissed by the teachings of those who simply wish to ignore the reality that our universe, our planet, our solar system, and its place in the galaxy have been skillfully crafted by a master designer and builder. So, the premise of the sermon is that our universe has been fine-tuned to support life. And I became aware of this fact, I guess, around the mid-90s when I read this book by Hugh Ross. He's a scientist, he's a PhD and a Christian, and it's called The Cosmos and the Creator. Now, when he wrote this book, he contended that there were at least 26 physical constants and properties of the universe that had been crafted, fine-tuned. It was like you went into a control room and you found all the parameters that govern the way the universe works. And you found a row of 26 knobs, and each of those 26 knobs had been set to the one place on the dial that it needed to be to support life. So let me just read you from page 118 a list of some of the things that Hugh Ross contends have been fine-tuned in order to make the universe the kind of place that it needs to be for us to live. Now, we know that matter is made up of atoms, and atoms have an outer core of electrons or an outer shell of electrons and an inner core where most of the matter of the atom resides in neutrons and protons. And these neutrons and protons are in a constant state of attraction and repulsion for each other because of the fundamental forces that exist within the atom. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but there are four main forces in nature. There are forces that only operate within the nucleus of an atom, and they're called the strong force and the weak force. And we don't experience those on a day-to-day basis. But the other two forces, gravity, of course, we contend with gravity every day, and it's a losing battle, isn't it? We fight gravity every day. Gravity is the central force of all the forces that we encounter. Gravity is the central force in our life. And then there's also electromagnetism, which is providing the lights that light up this room. And if it were not for electromagnetism, our lives would be vastly different. But the balance between all four of these forces has been fine-tuned meticulously in order to make the kind of place that the universe is and that we experience. So Ross says, this is the evidence for the fine-tuning of universe. He says more than 24 parameters for the universe must have values falling within narrowly defined ranges for life of any kind to exist. So I'll just read you some of these forces. The strong nuclear force, which I mentioned and I won't explain to you. The weak nuclear force constant. He says if it was larger, too much hydrogen would be converted to helium. If smaller, too little helium produced from the Big Bang. Hence, too few heavy elements made by star burning. The gravitational force constant, very important. I'll talk about this in more detail later. If God had made the gravitational force larger, stars would be too hot and would burn up too quickly. If it was smaller, stars would remain so cool that nuclear fusion would never ignite. Therefore, there would be no heavy element production. The electromagnetic force constant. If God had made it larger, there would be insufficient chemical bonding. Elements more massive than boron would be too unstable. So life wouldn't be possible because many of the atoms that make up our bodies wouldn't be able to exist. The ratio of the electromagnetic force to gravitational constant. If it was larger, there would be no stars less than 1.4 solar masses. So a star the size of our sun would not be able to exist. And it just goes on and on. The electron ratio of the ratio of electron to proton mass. If larger, insufficient chemical bonding. If smaller, insufficient chemical bonding. So it's right where it has to be. It's a dial that's been fine-tuned like a micrometer. The expansion rate of the universe. If it was a larger rate, if the galaxies were expanding from each other faster, there'd be no galaxy formation. If smaller, the universe would collapse prior to star formation. The velocity of light, which is 6 trillion miles per year, that's how fast light travels. If faster, stars would be too luminous. If it was slower, the stars wouldn't be luminous enough. So God has fine-tuned the speed of light so that the stars have just the right brightness and luminosity. The age of the universe. If the age of the universe was older, no solar-type stars would be in a stable burning phase in the right part of the galaxy. If younger, solar-type stars in the stable burning phase would not yet have formed. And it goes on and on and on. I won't read you anymore, but you get the idea that the conditions necessary to support life and make this universe the kind of the place that it is have been fine-tuned. And scientists recognize this. They understand that. Our present knowledge shows us that the universe can no longer be explained as an accident. The universe, the creation of the universe, the creation of life, not possible any longer, reasonably, to explain it as an accident. We talked a little bit about the strength of gravity. It's tuned to unimaginable precision. Imagine a very large tape measure. It's graduated in inches. All right? Imagine the largest tape measure you can think of. Well, you didn't think big enough, because this tape measure that I'm talking about is as wide as the universe. So here's how many inches wide it is. Imagine a tape measure, if you will, graduated in inches, that many inches wide. All right? So I'll draw a picture of it for you. So that's the tape measure, and the arrow indicates the place where the strength of gravity is indicated by the size of that tape measure. Now, if God were to take the gravitational force constant and move it 1 inch in either direction, it would throw everything out of whack and life would not be able to exist. The precision with which God fine-tuned the gravitational constant is one part in 10 to the 27th. That's 10 with 27 zeros after it. And if I counted right, that's how many zeros are on that chart right now. If moved by one inch, gravity would be a billion times stronger. If God had made the gravitational constant one part in 10 to the 27th larger, gravity would be a billion times greater than it is. And a planet with the Earth's gravity wouldn't be, 5,000 miles in diameter. It would only be 40 feet in diameter. So you see, the gravitational constant had to be where it is to have a planet the size of the Earth to have a reasonable biosphere. If God had made the gravitational constant larger, our bodies would be so heavy that we could not survive. Our bones wouldn't be able to support our weight, and organisms larger than insects would not be able to exist. But if he had made it smaller, if he had put the mark on the other side of the arrow, stars would be so cool that no heavy elements could be produced. So we see that the gravitational constant has been fiddled with. It has been tinkered with. It has been tweaked to be perfect. Well, not only do we find ourselves in a universe that has perfect parameters for the physics of the way things work, we find ourselves living on a planet that is uniquely suited to support us. The Earth is unique. We live in the only planet that's ever been discovered that has an oxidizing atmosphere. Our atmosphere is about 19 or 20% oxygen. It's about 78% nitrogen, which prevents the entire atmosphere from igniting into flames. But no other planet has ever been found that has an oxidizing atmosphere. They all have reducing atmospheres. Chemically, they're just the exact opposite of planet Earth. But we know that we need oxygen. We need an oxidizing atmosphere to survive in order to live. It's oxygen that gives us our energy. Additionally, our atmosphere with oxygen in it forms ozone, a molecule of oxygen that filters out harmful UV radiation. So our atmosphere has been fine-tuned to allow just enough radiation through to drive photosynthesis and allow us to have plants, to have plant life. Our Earth is one of the only planets that has a significant magnetic field. This magnetic field is very important because it shelters the Earth from the solar wind that has already stripped away most of the atmosphere from our neighbor planet, Mars. Mars had an atmosphere at one point, but Mars has such a weak magnetic field that its magnetic field was not able to protect it from solar flares and from solar wind. And over millions of years, most of the atmosphere of Mars has been blown away by the solar wind. But our atmosphere remains intact because of the magnetic field. The orbit of the Earth around the Sun is nearly circular. The result is that we have a stable climate. We have stable temperatures. It's very important that the Earth be in the zone where we are. We're in the water zone. We're in the very thin margin where liquid water can exist. Without liquid water, of course, life would be impossible on the Earth. If the Earth was 2% closer to the Sun, we wouldn't have liquid water. We'd only have water vapor and steam. If it was 2% farther from the Sun, we'd only have ice. Life would be very difficult, if not impossible. So another unique thing about our Earth is that it's not really a planet. Isaac Asimov, you may have heard of him, he was a famous writer who died a few years ago, wrote hundreds and hundreds of books on science and science fiction. One of my favorites that he wrote is called The Double Planet, and it's about the Moon and Earth system. Here's a picture. This is called the Blue Marble. And it's a picture of the Earth that was taken about 1997, about this time in 1997, as a matter of fact. And it shows a picture of the Earth and the Moon. And the Earth and the Moon system is unique because, as I said, the Earth is not just a planet. The Earth and the Moon is a double planet because no other planet has a satellite, a natural satellite, which is so close in size and mass as the Moon is to the Earth. Of course, Mars has two satellites, two moons, Deimos and Phobos, but they're little more than rocky asteroids that somehow got captured by Mars's gravitational field. They're not significantly close to the size or the mass of Mars. They don't really have an impact on the planet. They're just there, and we can see them in a telescope. Of course, the outer planets, Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune, all these planets have many, many satellites, but they're very, very small fractions of the size of the planet itself. So the Earth is unique in that it has a natural satellite that is on the same order of magnitude of mass and size. So the moon provides many, many benefits. I want to show you one more picture. This is, you see, these two little dots here down on the left side of the screen. This is a picture taken by a robot spacecraft that's headed toward Mercury. It's called MESSENGER. And I found this picture online at the astronomy picture of the day this week. This is a picture of what the Earth and the Moon look like from Mercury. Now, the spacecraft isn't quite there yet, so they had to adjust the picture a little bit. But this, if you could stand on the planet Mercury and look back toward the Earth, this is what you would see. And you'd see something remarkable. You'd see a planet and its satellite, and the satellite is similar, not as large as, but at least similar in scale to the size of the planet itself. And that's one thing that makes our Earth and our Moon absolutely unique in the solar system. So the Moon provides many, many benefits that I want you to think about. The first of all is the remarkable coincidence of the Moon's diameter with respect to the Sun's diameter and the distance from the Moon to the Sun. The Moon is 400 times smaller than the Sun. But guess what? It's also exactly 400 times farther away than the Sun. Do you know what that means? That means that when the Moon passes in front of the Earth, between the Earth and the Sun, the Earth becomes the only place in the solar system where you can witness a solar eclipse. The Moon perfectly moves over the surface of the Sun, completely covers up, but no more, the surface of the Sun and creates a solar eclipse. And the benefits to mankind have been many, because the ability to view the Sun during a total solar eclipse has taught us about the outer atmosphere of the Sun, its corona. As a matter of fact, during an eclipse of the Sun in 1918, scientists were able to confirm some parts of Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, because he predicted that light moving through a strong gravitational field would be bent. And during the total eclipse of 1918, a star was observed, but out of position. It was not observed where it was expected to be. It was observed very close to the Sun. It could be seen because the Moon had moved in front of the Sun. The sky became dark. The stars became visible. The position of the star was noted. It was out of place. Why was it out of place? Because the gravity of the Sun was actually bending the rays of light that were traveling toward the Earth. So the ability of scientists to use the phenomenon of a lunar solar eclipse has been a great benefit in scientific investigation. Allowed us to corroborate parts of a very controversial theory that was still a young theory. The Earth, our position in space, as I said, the only place in the solar system where this could be observed was on the Earth. And we live on a planet that was designed as a platform for investigation. And not only that, we live in the age of investigation. God has put us here in the age of investigation. The Moon is receding from the Earth. The distance between the Earth and the Moon has not been a constant forever. The Moon is receding from the Earth at a rate of about an inch and a half per year. So millions and millions of years ago, the Moon was much closer to the Earth, and the Moon would more than cover up the disk of the Sun. And millions of years from now, when the Moon has receded, by several hundred thousand miles, perhaps, it will no longer provide solar eclipses. So now is the time. Now is the time when God put us here on the earth. We live in the age of scientific investigation. Another benefit of this double system, the earth and the moon, is that the moon stabilizes the rotation of the earth. You know, we all know that the earth, the North Pole doesn't point straight up with respect to its orbit around the sun. It's tilted at an axis of about 23.5 degrees. Has been for millions of years. And thanks to the moon, will continue to be the same tilt. The moon stabilizes, this was not discovered until about 15 years ago, the moon stabilizes the axis of rotation of the earth at 23.5 degrees. Venus and Mars' axis of rotation are not as stable, and there's evidence that they may have shifted throughout the eons. This is an important factor in the maintenance of stable climate and temperature on the Earth. Furthermore, the moon balances life on planet Earth because it helps to create the tides. It powers the ocean currents that distribute nutrients. Because of the tides and because of the currents, the moon helps to distribute heat and stabilize temperature throughout the planet. Well, as I said, it's no accident that we have a moon. The moon was put there to keep life in balance on the Earth, as in addition to its timekeeping functions. As we know, the Hebrew calendar is solar and lunar, so the moon has timekeeping functions as well. But in terms of supporting life, the moon is a valuable resource for the Earth. Well, we don't just have a moon, we have a sun too. This is our sun. It's a unique star. It was long thought that the sun was just an average star, but we found out recently that it's much more than average. This is a huge ball of hydrogen that is burning in a nuclear furnace. The mechanism that powers the sun is nuclear fusion. It takes light atoms of hydrogen and fuses them together to make another gas called helium. When that happens, heat and light and radiation are released. And the sun does this at a very controlled and a very slow rate, so that the sun is right now about 5 billion years old, scientists believe, and it's about halfway through its life. It's expected that the sun could live in its present state for another 5 billion years before it runs out of fuel. And as I said, it's a nuclear furnace. It's not a coal-driven or a wood-driven furnace. It used to be thought, before in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, it was thought that the sun was just burning fuel like wood. Well, if you had a pile of wood the size of the sun, it could burn for 6,000 years, no more. But the sun is going to burn for another 5 billion years unless some force puts an end to it first. The sun is huge. Most of the mass of the solar system is in the sun. 99.9% of the mass of the solar system is locked up in the sun. The sun is about 800,000 to a million miles wide. It's a million times the volume of the Earth. And it's 333,000 times the mass of the Earth. So the sun puts out more energy in 1 second, radiates out into space more energy in 1 second than mankind has used in all of his existence. So the sun is an incredible resource of energy, a very stable resource. So we used to think that the sun was just an average star. It's been proposed that because there are so many stars in the universe, bear in mind, in our own galaxy, I'll show you what a galaxy is. In our own galaxy, there are 100 to 200 billion stars. Great, so let me write that down. That number, 200 billion, that's the number of stars that we estimate are in our galaxy, the Milky Way. Well, how many galaxies are there? They've estimated 100 billion galaxies. So if you're good with math, multiply 200 billion times 100 billion and see what you come up with. An incredible number of stars. Has anyone heard of Carl Sagan? Who knows Carl Sagan? Carl Sagan was an astronomer and a writer, and he produced TV shows. Carl Sagan was an atheist, a proponent of evolution. Carl Sagan estimated that a thousandth of a percent of all stars can support life. So if he was correct about that, there would be 100 trillion stars in the universe that could support life. Surely, if there are 100 trillion stars in the universe that could support life, several of them must have been the cause for life to evolve, right? Nearly every TV show about the universe, there's an excellent series that appears on the History Channel called The Universe, and nearly every one of them touches on the search our search to find this extraterrestrial life that evolutionary scientists believe must be out there. Wherever there is a possibility that water exists now or has existed, scientists are looking for traces of life. Now, scientists believe that life is like instant soup. You remember that commercial, Is It Soup Yet? Is It Soup Yet? I forget what kind of soup that was. But scientists believe that life is like instant soup or mashed potatoes. Just add water. As long as you have an environment that has temperatures that are suitable and water, they believe you can have life. We've got rovers on the surface of Mars scratching into the rocks and scratching into the dirt to find evidence that water might have been there at one time, to find evidence of single-celled animals that might have lived there. One of the moons of Jupiter, Europa, is a water and ice world. There's a crust of ice. The scientists believe that beneath the ice, there's liquid water. It will be a target if time goes on long enough. In the search for life in the solar system, the SETI program analyzes thousands of radio signals for patterns that signal intelligence. The Pioneer probes that we sent out into the cosmos in the 70s carried plaques that depicted humans and the position of planet Earth. The Voyager satellites carried gold-plated records that carried information about Earth's inhabitants and its cultures. And in 1973, a picture was beamed into space from the giant Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico, depicting numbers from 1 to 10 and carrying diagrams of simple chemical compounds. The destination was a globular cluster, which I will show you shortly, called M13. Robot spacecraft are presently scraping the barren sands of Mars in an attempt to find fossils or even traces of long-dead bacteria or traces that water might have existed there. Carl Sagan was instrumental in having that radio message beamed to M13. We are expending a lot of energy and effort and time and money to find life in other places in our solar system, other places in the galaxy. And it puzzles me that we can't maintain friendly relationships with our own kind. And yet, we expend enormous energy trying to find life forms that are potentially vastly different from us. So, scientists say there are trillions and trillions and trillions of stars. Surely, life has evolved on planets orbiting bazillions of these stars around alien suns. But the requirements for life are very, very stringent. First of all, life as we know it, our life certainly could not exist in a solar system where there are multiple stars. Now, our sun is unique in that regard. Our sun is a solitary star, but most stars are members of binary or tertiary systems and must be eliminated as places where life could exist. Most stars exist in families of stars that all orbit around each other. And if there are planets in those kinds of solar systems, their orbits are very unusual, very unstable. Their climates would not be suitable for life. Lone stars like the Sun are rare in the galaxy. 44% of stars like the Sun have star companions. Red giants and blue giants are not stable enough to be the hosts for planets containing life. They don't live long enough. They have very unstable outputs of energy. They are subject to huge coronal mass ejections. Now, our sun does that too. Let me see if I can back up and show you. If you notice this huge flare down here at the bottom, can you see my arrow? This may be a part of a coronal mass ejection where huge waves of ionized particles are blown out of the sun. And this happens to the sun from time to time, but not as frequently as with other stars. So red dwarfs and blue giants are not suitable because their coronal mass ejections are much more violent. They're not safe places to have habitable planets. The sun is kind of unique in that it is more massive than 90% of all the stars that we have observed. Now, the sun is by no means one of the largest stars. There are stars such as Arcturus, which are many hundreds or thousands of times more massive than the sun, and black holes exist that have millions of times the mass of our sun. But the sun is a pretty hefty star. It's in the 90th percentile. So 90% of all stars have less mass than our sun. And the sun is optimized. So those 90% are not likely candidates for life. More massive stars than the sun have shorter lifespans. Now, a recent article in Astronomy Magazine, the June issue, describes the search for stars like the sun. So far, the search has been fruitless. In our galaxy or in other galaxies, scientists have been unable to find a star that is like the sun and satisfies all the conditions that the sun provides that make life possible here on Earth. The sun, for instance, has fewer output peaks than most stars. Now, you may remember that the sun has an 11-year cycle of sunspots. It goes through a minimum and a maximum every 11 years. It was very striking for us in 2003 or 4. It was sunset. I was pulling into the driveway, and my son was standing in the driveway. And he said, "Dad, look at that red patch over there." And I looked in the northwest, and the sky was glowing just about that color. It was glowing orange. There was a huge patch of orange in the sky. And I said, "Well, it's just sunlight reflecting off a cloud." He says, "No, I've been watching it for a long time." The sun had already gone down. And he said, "I've been watching it for a long time." He said, "It's not a cloud." And we watched it until it got dark and it became apparent to us we were looking at the Aurora Borealis. There had been a coronal mass ejection earlier in the week, or about a week before. The sun had had a blow up like this. It aimed straight at the Earth. And the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, filled up with ionized particles. And I took some pictures of it. Unfortunately, my digital camera is subject to noise, but I do have some pictures of the Aurora Borealis, and I never expected to see it in the daytime at this latitude. Normally, you can only see it at night. So I did get a couple pictures, a couple grainy, noisy digital pictures of that Aurora Borealis in about 2003. So the sun goes through an 11-year cycle. Every 11 years, we can expect a solar maximum, where the sun spews out a lot of energy and a lot of particles. An 11-year cycle is really unusual. Most other stars that we've examined have a 6-year cycle. So if our sun was one of those other stars, we would be twice as likely to be receiving dangerous doses of radiation from our star. So in that the sun has fewer output peaks than most stars, it's twice as stable as any other star we know. The sun has been a very consistent and safe source of energy for planet Earth. Many stars have long lifespans and are stable, but they're so dim and so cool that the Earth would have to orbit very, very close to the star in order to maintain liquid water. Now, you know how the moon is tidally locked with the Earth? Do you know what I mean? Has anybody ever seen the other side of the moon? No. Why? It's because the moon's rotation is synchronized with its revolution around the Earth is synchronized with its rotation. It's become tidally locked. So one face of the moon always faces the Earth, and we never see the other face. If the Earth were rotating around, say, a red dwarf, it would have to rotate so closely that it also would become tidally locked around its sun, the way the moon is around the Earth. And you know what that means? That means that one side would experience constant daylight and the other side would experience constant night. That would be unsuitable. The dark side would be a frozen wasteland. The year would be shorter. The Earth would be rotating in a very close orbit around the sun, tidally locked, probably not the length of the year God had in mind for the annual holy day seasons. Additionally, some sun-like stars produce magnetic fields much more violent, much stronger than the sun's. And the risk of enormous coronal mass ejections is much higher. The planet would be bathed in frequent waves of lethal radiation. Chemically, the sun is different from other planets that we've examined. 73% of potential solar twins in our stellar neighborhood have been examined, and only 15% of them are chemically similar to the sun. The sun contains a very low percentage of heavy elements, those that vaporize at high temperatures. And these elements left the sun early in its development and formed the rocky inner planets. So the chance that some of these stars that may be sun-like have Earth-like planets is very, very low. So we see that there are a lot of requirements for a sun to have. It just can't be sitting in space and be luminous. It has to be the right size. It has to have the right stability. There are many, many requirements. It has to be a solitary star. It can't be a red dwarf. Carl Sagan vastly overestimated the number of stars that exist that can support life, and to this day, not one has been identified. Our star, the sun, that supports life on the Earth is unique. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that there's not another one in the universe like it that matches its remarkable qualities. God either designed the sun to have its collection of properties, or he handpicked it, or he fine-tuned it somehow to be the energy source for the planet where he made life. Well, the sun is just right. The Earth and the moon are just right. The sun's position in space is just right. First of all, the sun is in the right kind of a galaxy. You've heard me use the word galaxy. I'm going to explain to you what a galaxy is. Oh, I wanted to talk about this a little bit. This picture is M13. This is the globular cluster where Carl Sagan proposed that we send the radio message. The trouble with globular clusters is that the density of stars is very, very high. You can see that there are perhaps hundreds of thousands to millions of stars in this object. This is an object within our galaxy. It's called M13. It's in the constellation of Hercules. It's a globular cluster. It's a very ancient collection of stars. Maybe we'll come back to that. This is a galaxy. This is a nearby galaxy. This is in the catalog. It's called M31. It's the Andromeda Galaxy. It's about 3.2 million light years from us. In other words, the light that exposed this photographic plate traveled for 3.2 million years before it arrived at Earth. And this is a spiral galaxy. We believe that that our own galaxy, which we are inside, and makes it difficult to see exactly what it looks like, we believe that our own spiral galaxy, the Milky Way, looks very similar to this galaxy. So the sun is a resident in a spiral galaxy. Well, there are other galaxies besides spiral galaxies. There are also elliptical galaxies, and there are irregular galaxies. Only 5% of all the galaxies that exist are spiral galaxies. And stars living in elliptical galaxies are not candidates for life. This is another spiral galaxy. This one is very close to the last star in the handle of the Big Dipper. It's called the Whirlpool Galaxy, and it's interacting gravitationally with that other galaxy that you see, the one that's colored kind of yellow. Just everything that I'm showing you can be seen in a moderate-sized backyard telescope, and I've seen this, and I've seen M13 and the other things that I've showed you today. But this is I just wanted to give you a couple examples of spiral galaxies. They're very beautiful. And remember that only 5% of all galaxies are spiral galaxies. Most of them are irregular or elliptical. This is a picture of an elliptical galaxy. Now, in a spiral galaxy, everything orbits the galactic center. There are hundreds of billions of stars in this galaxy, and they're all following orbits around the center of this galaxy. It might take them millions of years to make one circuit around the galaxy. But each one of the stars, and the stars look like dust here. You can't see any individual stars in this galaxy. Any stars that you can see, like this one, they're in our own galaxy. We're looking past that to see this whirlpool galaxy. As a matter of fact, Isaac Asimov wrote a book called The Stars Like Dust. And when you look out at the galaxies, you see dust. But that dust is composed of billions of stars. But the stars circle the galactic center in fairly regular orbits when they're living in spiral galaxies. Different situation than in elliptical galaxies. This galaxy, if we could see it, it would look like an egg. And the orbits of the stars around this kind of a galaxy take the star to every position of the galaxy sooner or later. You see a shaft of light emanating from the center of the galaxy. This shaft of light is really a beam of particles being beamed out through space at nearly the speed of light. And where are they coming from? They're coming from a huge black hole at the center of this galaxy. Any star system passing through that beam of radiation would be sterilized completely. It would be very dangerous if the sun were a member of an elliptical galaxy. A star rotating in an elliptical galaxy through the ages will visit every area of that galaxy. Low star density, high star density, areas of moderate radiation, areas of very high radiation. An elliptical galaxy is not a suitable place for life. This is an artist's conception of our own galaxy, the Milky Way, looking down from the top. Spiral galaxies are shaped like disks, and the position of our sun is fortuitous in this galaxy. Notice that there's a spiral arm here, another spiral arm here, and this is the position of our sun. It's between spiral arms. It's not in a spiral arm. It's in an area of low density. There are a lot of benefits for the sun to be in this rift between spiral arms. The sun's orbit around the galactic center is very stable, and it keeps us away from other stars. It keeps us away from areas of high stellar density where the radiation is higher. It keeps us out of dangerous areas of the galaxy where beams of radiation could sterilize the planet. We're very certain, because of observations that we've made, that at the center of our galaxy is a massive black hole with millions upon millions of times the mass of our sun. This black hole would be spewing out radiation from its poles. It would be very dangerous indeed, to live near the galactic center, an area of very high radiation, an area of very high stellar density. What does that mean for our stable orbit? Remember, we count on having a stable orbit around the sun to maintain our climate. If we were living in an area of high stellar density in the galactic center or in a spiral arm, the orbit of the Earth could be disturbed by the gravitational force of other stars nearby. But as we live in a rift between spiral arms, the radiation density is much smaller, and the chance that the orbit of the Earth would be perturbed by another star is also much smaller. Let's back up now and look back at, since I've given you some of that information, M13. It would be very dangerous for the sun to live in this galaxy. The stars are more closely packed. It's not a galaxy, it's a globular cluster. The stars are more closely packed. The radiation is much higher. But it's very unlikely that life would be possible in a globular cluster, because globular clusters typically have a deficiency of heavy elements and the materials necessary to build human bodies and other creatures and plants just is not there. So the Earth is in the perfect place for life. It has the perfect companion, the moon. It has the perfect energy source, the sun. The sun is in the perfect place to support life in just the right kind of galaxy, a spiral galaxy. God has tucked us away out here in a corner of this spiral galaxy where virtually nothing can hurt us. So, it should be evident to man that God has constructed the universe and placed us here where he did with great precision to support life. He's put man in a safe place. He's put us on a platform designed for scientific observation at the right time, at the right time of the age of the universe. So what is man's answer? Scientists understand this. It's becoming harder and harder for scientists to deny that the universe is not an accident, that it has been designed meticulously by a genius. It's becoming harder and harder for them to deny it. So what is man's answer? Man's answer is this. Our just right universe, we admit it's a just right universe, but it's only one of an infinite number of universes. It's been postulated now that there are an infinite number of universes, each with a different set of physical circumstances. So one of them had to be just right. And this is only a theory. There is no observation. There is no evidence to indicate that our universe is just one of many universes. It's just a ploy to get scientists out of a position that they can't explain. There is no observation. There is no evidence that supports the idea that there are multiple universes. It's a play on the evolution, aeons of evolution can produce any result theory. And further, man says that God's existence can't be proved scientifically. We cannot make observations that prove or disprove that there is God. And therefore, any talk about God in the scientific community is inadmissible. Now, where did this idea come from? This is really disturbing. This is the source of most of our problems in the world today. The existence of God can't be proved by observation and therefore is inadmissible. Now, I forget if it was Galileo or Da Vinci who said, everything that we know, we have learned through our five senses. And that's our problem. That's our problem in this modern world. Everything we know, we have learned through our five senses. What did we leave out? Does anybody know? If your base of knowledge is everything that you've learned through your five senses, what are you forgetting about? Revelation. You're ignoring revelation from God. We rejected revelation and made up our own body of knowledge. Clearly, we are operating on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Scientists say you cannot allow the idea of a designer into your thinking because it's unscientific. See, there's a flaw in scientific thinking. God has already answered this objection. You're wondering, am I ever going to turn to a scripture? How about Romans 1:18? Let's turn over there. Romans 1:18, this is something I'm not willing to experience firsthand. The wrath of God. It says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteous, ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold, and the word should be suppress, the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. In other words, it's clear to them. They see it. For God has showed it to them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. And we've just seen those things. We've just taken a quick romp through our part of the galaxy and the close by galaxies. And we've seen those things being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. They have no excuse. They can see it, but they suppress the truth unrighteously nonetheless. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations. Multiple universes, theory of evolution, total vanity in their imaginations. And their foolish heart was darkened. So Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking, did I mention that Stephen Hawking is coming out with a new book this month wherein he dispenses with the need to have God. He's figured out how we can have a creation without having a creator. Their foolish minds have been darkened. That's how God describes them. Their foolish heart was darkened, he said. God has showed scientists the truth, yet many of them, fewer and fewer as the years go by, but many of them refuse to acknowledge Him. God has made it so plain, says Paul, that they have no excuse. There's one fellow that if God ever sits down and interviews him, I might like to be a fly on the wall. Did anyone see the movie Expelled, the movie that Ben Stein made a couple years ago? Well, they interviewed this evolutionary biologist. He's English. His name is Richard Dawkins. He's an atheist, a secular humanist. Dawkins is harshly critical of the idea of intelligent design. And the interviewer asked him in the movie, what would you say to God if there was a God, and if you were able to meet Him face to face, what would you say to God? And Dawkins said, and my jaw dropped when he said it, I would ask Him, why did you hide yourself? Well, God hasn't hidden Himself. He's made His presence abundantly and manifestly known by the things that He's made. According to Paul, God will tell Dawkins he had no excuse for disbelieving and not seeing that God had not hidden Himself. The evidence was all there. He didn't have the courage and the honesty to accept it. His foolish heart was darkened. Continuing in Romans, it says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image, made like corruptible man and to birds and to four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies in themselves. And skipping down to verse 28, it says, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. So we have, you remember the quote, you can't talk about God because it's outside the realm of observation. God is outside of our body of knowledge. He's been stricken from our body of knowledge. God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things that are not convenient. So we excluded God from our body of knowledge. Now there's a term I want to introduce you to. It's called epistemology. It's the study of how knowledge is acquired. How do we know what we know, and what do we know, and how does this knowledge get into our database? And as I said, it was either Da Vinci or Galileo that said, all that we know has been learned through our senses, and that's a fault because we excluded revelation. We took revelation from God out of the picture. That should not be. We should accept God's revelation. But our knowledge, our epistemology, is not a product of revelation for the most part, but by observation. What do people know? How do they know it? And when did man reject God's revelation? Let's turn over to Genesis. That's where the answer is. Right from the beginning, God provided man with the revelation of the knowledge that he could not acquire for himself. Genesis 2:16. God is giving man revelation. When God gives us revelation, we need to pay attention. God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you eat of thereof you shall surely die. This was important information. It was vital. It was important that the man wouldn't learn this by observation or experience. He had to learn it by revelation, because learning it by observation, learning it by experience, was going to be deadly. God was giving life-saving information to Adam and Eve. Did mankind believe the Creator? Next chapter, chapter 3. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, hey, hasn't God said you shouldn't eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree that's in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, ah, you won't surely die. God knows that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good as evil, knowing good and evil. So you'd be able to make up your own body of knowledge. And God knows that. God's defrauding you. God's exploiting you. God's using you for his own nefarious purpose. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food. So now, what's happening here? Right here, mankind begins to rely on observation instead of revelation. And observation trumps revelation. She saw that it was good for food. She's using her senses and ignoring revelation. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and desired to make one wise, she looked at the fruit of it and ate it and gave it to her husband, and he did eat. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. So it started right with the first man and the first woman. They started a trend that continues to this day. They rejected revelation in favor of observation. God's revelation to mankind is, for the most part, ignored. The Expositor's Bible Commentary says this about that passage of Scripture. The inference of God's command is that God alone knows what is good for man and that God alone knows what is not good for him. To enjoy the good, man must trust God and obey him. If man disobeys, he will have to decide for himself what is good and what is not good. So we're at the end of 6,000 years of what that is, and we can see the results of it. While to modern man such a prospect may seem desirable, to the author of Genesis, it is the worst fate that could have befallen him. Only God knows what is good for man. Only God can know and decide what is good. That's exactly what happened to mankind. We have been forced to construct an epistemology that is devoid of revelation from God and rejects revelation from God and will not let revelation from God become a part of it. Our body of knowledge contains information that is good. A lot of it is good, but it's a mixture of misinformation and error, or that will cause adversity. And God is allowing us to learn the hard way. So the lessons that I want us to learn from this today is that although we have brilliant people, and I'm not denigrating the intellect of people like Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking. They're brilliant people, but their minds and their hearts have been darkened. We can't trust them to produce absolute truth from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They cannot recognize the truth, and whether knowingly or unknowingly, they suppress the truth. The knowledge that they produce, the knowledge about the universe, and the cause of the universe, and the design of the universe, the knowledge they produce is a mixture of information that's good and misinformation that's hurtful. And our faith should not be challenged by the product of darkened, foolish human minds that reject God's existence and that reject his revelation. Our God fine-tuned this universe for us to live in. He's a brilliant physicist and engineer. He made the universe just right for life, and he made it for us. And I want to finish by reciting the last verse to a song that Mark Graham wrote called Great God Who Made the Universe. I think it's very fitting. It goes, Great God who made the universe and calls the stars by name, who set the sun and moon and all the planets in their frame, who made a billion galaxies and scattered them through space, who made a jewel and called it Earth and gave it honored place.